Welcome to The Sandbox, a Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast. Participate in the podcast and get your level 7 access by calling 304-837-2278 or go to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Dave.
Welcome everybody to The Sandbox, a Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast, broadcasting from Lighthouse Level 3, home of Max, Shotgun X, and a whole mess of roaches. My name is Mike.
And I'm Dave, and this is show number 86 of The Sandbox, where we'll be discussing Season 5, Episode 7 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. entitled Together or Not at All, which aired January 12th, 2018.
And this episode was written by Matt Owens, directed by Brad Turner. This is a relatively new team that did episode 404 last season, but they did a great one here. And I just want to mention up front that we had some input from Facebook, I believe. It might have been Jeff Childs. Sorry if I'm misattributing that. But Flint, it turns out, is a hero from the Marvel Universe. He goes by Flint. The name of the actual person is Jason, but his hero name is Flint. Here, of course, in S.H.I.E.L.D., his actual name is Flint. But just like Flint here in this show, he could make Earth fly around and could even make it into armor for himself and even fly people around on chunks of Earth. So it sounds like a really cool inhuman power, because he wasn't inhuman in the comics as well. And here he's played by Coy Stewart, who I looked him up. I actually, because I have a young daughter, I do remember him from the Electric Company, the reboot of the Electric Company. Who he played Marcus on that show. So relatively new actor, but I think he's been doing a great job, and you almost wish he would join the cast.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that. Are they planning to add him? I don't know. It looks as if the 100th episode is scheduled for March, right? And if I understand correctly, that would be the 12th episode.
Yes, episode 512.
So is that going to be the first episode of the second pod, which it certainly appears that's the way they're going. So hopefully Flint will not be making a quick exit in pod number one.
Especially since the word through the grapevine is that episode 100 is quite heart-wrenching. So just building it up, I think, in some cases to a very momentous time in the series, but also perhaps in the story as well. So something to look forward to. In fact, we're actually going to be hitting our 100th episode of The Sandbox with the penultimate episode, episode 521. So that'll be a nice way to end things up with episode 100 and 101. We'll have to think of something.
Seems like just yesterday we started this podcast.
Somebody make us a cake. All right. But we've got a great episode to talk about here. So let's get right into it with our episode discussion.
All right, Mike. Well, you know, in the show news, you mentioned Flint, and of course, we know that he can assemble rocks into a weapon, and we've talked about the possibility, oh, is he going to put Earth back together, which, you know, I guess is still in play at this point. But this is certainly an episode where we do get another possible idea for how the Earth exploded, and that's, of course, the reappearance of gravitonium.
Yes, that's definitely a dangerous substance that harkens all the way back to season one. So, you know, we had the callback to season three with the appearance of Robin, but now we're going even farther back for this one.
Yeah, so how did he get from the fridge to the lighthouse? Because, I mean, as I recall, it was put away in the fridge for safekeeping.
Well, who knows? When Hydra got involved, all that stuff in the fridge got emptied out. To extend the metaphor.
Okay, so Dr. Hall still alive, maybe? Is gravitonium available someplace else other than the cache we knew about on Earth?
Well, especially since we are arguing quite a bit against the science of what's going on the surface of Earth with there being able to be an atmosphere and gravity at all. They've got the gravity storms, of course, which, you know, I guess is kind of a pseudo-scientific way of explaining it away, but perhaps gravitonium is involved there too. Who knows?
Okay. But regardless, it was cool that it came back. I definitely like that. Now, one of the things you mentioned, science, is the lighthouse some kind of time machine, among other things?
Well, how do you mean?
Well, can we jump to the epilogue or do you want to hold that till
the
end?
No, we can totally skip around. We've been doing it all season.
Okay, so we get to the epilogue, and when I say clearly that's Robin,
yeah,
you know, maybe that's not clear, but I'm assuming it is.
Well, let's see. Maybe she's just super old, right? 70-some years have passed, and she was under age 10, I would think. So maybe she's in her 70s or 80s, yeah?
Yeah, she doesn't look that old. I don't know. Maybe.
Times are hard on Earth right now.
Okay. Well, let's just leave it at this point. For me, there's something more to the lighthouse than just a survival bunker.
Oh, it's clearly something more to it because of the fact that it was built in very mysterious circumstances in the past. But as for it being a time machine, I'm not so sure. But certainly, whoever was involved in its construction had some advanced knowledge of, you know, materials, science, and making it look like it was built in our time. So there's that.
All right. So who are the two other guys in the mask?
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess I hadn't really spared it much of the hut.
Hunter and Bobby?
Yeah. Well, actually, you say that. When they first started coming in and I saw the gray-haired lady in silhouette, I actually thought it was Bobby. I thought, would they do that? Maybe bring another actress in?
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't know what her contract is
yeah.
regarding the Orville, so right. there obviously is that, but how cool would that be? And certainly it's not out of the question, I guess, that it could be Hunter, since we're
yeah.
playing timey-wimey with time. But yeah. All right, now, a couple of things that occurred to me. Obviously, Fitz removes the damper, or whatever we're going to call it, that Cassius had placed in Simmons' ear. Are they going to be able to easily remove Daisy's limiter?
That's what I'm thinking, because I would think those two things would happen in the same episode, just for convenience sake. But yeah, that seems a little bit more difficult to extract.
Yeah, I love the scene when Fitz pulls out the drawer, empties all the tools on the floor, grabs a, you know, I'll call them a pair of pliers. I guess they were some sort of medical instrument, but this is going to hurt. Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't do some damage.
Yeah, I thought that as well. But yeah, once you saw the device, it probably hurt more going in than it did coming out. But
yeah.
All right. How much do we trust Deke? I, like most people, was glad to see Deke again. He's one of those characters that there's something about him that we really like. Of course, there's a lot we don't trust about him. But I don't know. How much do we trust him?
Yeah. He's such an interesting character, too, from the standpoint of he comes from a completely different world. And so, of course, he's going to have a different worldview than our S.H.I.E.L.D. agents. But we did kind of forget the fact that he was welded shut inside of a room. We were asking, where was he last week? Well, that answers that question. So I think maybe some of us forgot that aspect of it.
And we talked about how it's possible that perhaps he's playing a longer game, that it seems as if he sold out S.H.I.E.L.D., but perhaps he had a longer view of things. And of course, that's what he says, how much we trust him. I guess I want to trust him.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah.
So we'll leave it at that. Are you surprised they split the team up again? Because for me, now it's one thing, Mac talking about splitting up the team, not a good idea. Both he and Yo-Yo stay behind with Flint. And I'm thinking, well, what are you really planning to accomplish? You're going to save everybody?
Well, I think they want to take it further than just the mission of figuring out who's on the surface. And Max got that extra ingredient of having been a father who lost a daughter. And I get the sense that he's feeling a bit fatherly towards Flint. And Yo-Yo realizes that and wants to support him in that.
Yeah, but then why doesn't he tell the kid, look, you can't save everybody. You can't get rid of the Kree. Come with us. Because I don't know what they really hope to accomplish. So.
Yeah. Well, especially if they change things, this future will be less important anyway. Everyone will be saved or their existences will be erased by a completely different timeline. So,
yeah.
But that's hard to explain to someone like Flint who lives in it.
Well, it is. And I guess, and I certainly agree with you that he was taking a more fatherly approach. Yeah, I guess you could say big brother approach, but, mm-hmm. but he is probably 20, 25 years older than Flint. So I get that. Now, the other character that I continue to find fascinating is Cassius, and certainly we learn a lot about his backstory and how it is he ended up in the lighthouse. And for me now, it's a little difficult to get a handle on what I really think of him, especially that one scene where Sonara accuses him of begging, which it really surprised me when she told him she found it repulsive.
Yeah, there's a really difficult dynamic to try and pin down here, because at first we're trying to see it from Falnak's perspective, because obviously he has a lot of disdain for his brother, but obviously he doesn't have possession of all the facts. And it comes out, of course, that he was sent on a suicide mission, perhaps to get rid of him altogether. But there's still a lot of question marks. And one of them is how Sonara works into it. She's loyal, but she also in some ways seems to be a mentor or perhaps a reluctant protector. I don't want to say reluctant. Maybe that's too strong, but there's a certain amount of superiority sometimes with her.
Well, I see a lot of the same qualities in her that I see in Deke. And in terms of, you know, you talked about levels of trust. So how she's going to play out the rest of the way. But more to the point, what the heck's up with Chatty Cathy in this episode?
Yeah, she's downright verbose. Yeah, it's kind of weird because we're used to her stoicism. And so some of the lines come out feeling a little, I don't know, weak in terms of the delivery. I think she did a great job of portraying the emotions without speaking. And so it almost seems like a cop out to have her speak, but I'm glad she did because it gave us some insight, but it also felt wrong somehow just because we weren't used to it.
Well, and I like the fact that they kept it to a minimum. I mean, There was enough to just whet our appetites.
Right.
But as you said, it would almost feel as if it was wrong to have her speaking like that. But, you know, you mentioned Falnak, and he's here taking over. He's obviously there, as we know, to get the destroyer to take back to Daddy. But one of the first things I noticed is Cassius's preoccupation with the scars on his face and not the scars that the others have, which at first I thought they were ceremonial scars, which in fact they may be, mm-hmm. as opposed to battle scars.
Well, because even Sonara has them. They're like right next to their earlobes. I guess I thought that was anatomical, but then that doesn't explain why he doesn't have them.
Right. But given his preoccupation with flawless beauty, mm-hmm. I mean, dude must be, he must be dying inside.
Yeah, exactly. Because he killed that special servant that he had when Simmons first came around because he had a small blemish. I think it was a similar cut on his face.
Yeah. And I like the fact that we got a name for the fighting pit, right? They call it the crater.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool name.
That is a pretty cool name.
It probably is a literal crater, too.
And his brother brings his best fighter, Mastan Dar, and he's insistent, and this is, again, another thing I like, because a lot of the fights we saw in the crater were pretty much mismatches.
Yeah.
So Mastan Dar sees himself as a superior fighter, so if he's going to fight a human, it's going to be with a Terran weapon.
Right.
And he pulls out those curved knives. I don't know. There's probably an actual name for them.
Right. Just the fact that he has to use those kind of weapons and then also guns. So he can't have the floating master balls that right. that Sonara has.
Right. And then there's that little exchange between Sonara and Cassius where she really resents having been thrown into the pit. And he tries to play it off that, and you responded beautifully as I knew you would. And she's really having none of it. And you know, we've talked all along about the relationship between these two, and you know, you alluded to it a few minutes ago, we're still not exactly clear on what really is going on between these two, but certainly she's a little bit resentful that he threw her in there against Daisy.
And I feel like there's got to be more details coming. It seemed like they gave us the full story, but they wanted to use as a twist, just as Falnak was dying, the fact that Cassius knew he had been betrayed by going into the mission, knew that he would be seen as a coward for fleeing the battlegrounds, but actually informed his brother that he had his generals killed. But there's still a lot missing from that story, including why Sanara would support him in that. Like, what was going on that she felt that she could take this leap with Cassius, even though it would mean they would end up where they are now? Because I don't think it's been explained sufficiently.
Well, you know, assuming we believe what Cassius says, and Falmac doesn't dispute the facts that he presents, that their father gave him a fleet even though he had no training. So right away, that's kind of problematic. Number two, he's sent into a situation where they are severely outnumbered. Rather than lose the entire fleet, he chooses to withdraw, which seems to make sense to me. And I think most good commanders that we've read about throughout history knew when to retreat and live to fight another day. But somehow in their society, this is perceived as an act of cowardice. And that's, I guess, where we're at this point. And he said the last few weeks that this is all based on a misunderstanding.
Well, also, what was the thing that got him sent to the battlefield on a suicide mission to begin with?
Exactly.
Was it just his perceived weakness and the fact that he's not a warrior? He says something about the fact that he's not built for it. I mean, surely he has some kind of place in Kree culture without having to send him off on this grand decline in status.
Well, it seems as if it was purposeful.
Yeah, it does.
Get rid of him. So does the father want to get rid of him?
Seems like
it. Or is the brother perhaps somehow involved and twisted what was really supposed to take place?
That certainly could be true.
To get rid of his brother. Now, Sanara tells the brothers that S.H.I.E.L.D. has escaped and that she killed his warrior, Mastan Dar. And then, of course, now the brother is like, oh, okay, well, you know what? Why don't you come on to my side?
I thought that was great because it was a little bit strange and surprising as Mastan Dar was drilling away at that wall to get at Flint and bring him in by drilling those holes in the wall. And then for her to just take him out after he took down the wall was just interesting timing on Sanara's part. And I think Falnak admires her chutzpah in doing that.
Yeah, no question. Now, look, you talk about chutzpah. I love the fact that Cassius literally puts a bayonet in his brother's back. And I think the metaphor has to be looked at because I feel like he was stabbed in the back, whether by his father or his brother.
Oh, yes. Very appropriate.
Although when his brother mentions stabbing him in the back, he goes, yeah, well, I'll also stab my enemies in the front.
I'll go ahead and take care of that now. Yeah.
And I love that he was using, I don't know if that's a circa World War I carbine rifle with the bayonet on it, but
yeah, he had that nice collection.
Yeah. And now his plan is to tell the father that we have avenged my brother's death and brought you Daisy, the Destroyer of Worlds. Well, obviously he's the one that killed his brother. So there's obviously some kind of setup that he seems to be concocting in his mind. But, you know, look, we know he's not. Well, I shouldn't say we know he's not going to get Daisy to his father because that's possible. And then, of course, she'd have to escape and all of that.
But yeah. Well, the main thing, too, is he just went through this whole maneuver of overcoming his brother. What makes him think that his father is going to have any kind of change of heart either? Because once he found out Falnak was coming, oh, here's my chance to redeem myself, ends up killing him. His father's not going to see him any differently either, presumably. And so he's just going to have to, you know, take matters into his own hands again. But he says to Sanara that this is what we're going to do, and we're going to get my father to realize that I'm someone that's valuable. And I don't know if he's deceiving himself by saying that.
Well, from everything we've heard about his father, I would say he probably is deceiving himself. And I don't want to say that he doesn't seem like a good planner, militarily or otherwise, because I don't necessarily know that's true or not, but I'm still going to say it anyway. So
it could translate. He's a prison camp warden, really. Yeah. But it could translate to tactics as well. Who knows?
Okay. Well, speaking of tactics, Daisy, Fitz, and Simmons have regrouped. We get new clothes for Simmons. Wiped off that gold makeup pretty darn quickly. So,
well, you can still see it on her hairline. I actually kind of like that you can still see it up around her hair because it shows that they were keeping it real.
Right. And then I love, and this is certainly not the first time we've seen Daisy fight without her powers. And on occasion, she chooses not to use her powers and just fight with her actual fighting skills. And of course, that's what she has to do here and takes that guy out. But then they see Fitz's ship blown up.
I couldn't believe it. I really was surprised by that. That was not something I was expecting.
It wasn't something I was expecting. But then in retrospect, they had to know there was a ship outside.
And once they realized that Fitz was involved, which they, of course, did when he jumped into the crater, then they said, well, take out his ship so he can't get out of there. So, yeah, it totally makes sense. But and of course, it would be too easy if they could just make an escape that way. But the fact that they are forced to use the surface is what really excites me.
Yeah. Now, there aren't a ton of good lines in this episode. And in a way, in a few minutes, I'm going to tell you why I'm glad about that. But, you know, Daisy's taken charge during the escape. And Simmons tells her, I'm just glad to not be standing still. It feels good to be on the run. Well, okay, you know what she means. But
well, also, she was the one that was sitting in the servants' quarters the whole time. So she probably feels good just to not have to serve wine and such.
Right, right. But they find themselves in the hub for the life support systems, handily enough. And that's where they discover that they're using gravitonium to create the gravity. So,
right. I never thought that was really a problem underneath the ground. But it's like we were being so picky about the surface. But the lighthouse is really part of that same chunk. So in a way, it is kind of nice that they explained that. And when we see May, the fact that she's had trouble with gravity also shows that things are maybe not quite as simple as we've been making them and being critical about.
Right. And as to where they got the gravitonium, I guess we'll find out at some point, sooner probably rather than later. Daisy again takes on, this time, Maston Dar and holds him off long enough for everybody to get away. And then I love, there's all this smoke. Smoke clears. They're all gone.
Yeah. Nice try, buddy.
Nice. And then, of course, Deke shows up. I've come to save your ass. And again, I love. And this was kind of foreshadowed by Coulson early in the episode where he says that they're going to be on to us. We need to get on the move with all these dead bodies. They're going to follow us. And Deke, of course, says, oh, I found you guys. I just followed the dead bodies.
Exactly. He just did it faster than the Kree.
Right. Exactly. Now, Coulson, again, obviously we know Fitz gets shot, and I'm assuming it's just a flesh wound. He doesn't you know, seem to be bleeding out or anything. Nobody seems to be all that concerned. Simmons is there, so I'm sure she's doing her Simmons thing there. But Coulson shot Sonara, I thought.
Yeah.
And we talked last week. I thought the neck wound that Simmons gave to Cassius was going to be a lot more serious than it turned out to be. He had his little turtleneck on, I guess, to hide the scar from that.
No, it was his cheek. And that's the thing. When you saw the previously on S.H.I.E.L.D., you could see her do the move with the knife, and it was across his face, not his neck.
Okay.
So I think we just got that entirely wrong altogether.
Okay. Well, Daisy's, she's in a hurry. Mr. and Mrs. Boba Fett will be here any minute. And I'm thinking like, okay. You know, I think you guys in the writer's room are trying a little bit too hard. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, that's what we were saying, that there's not quite as many humorous lines in this one. And I think Faith is going to probably mention that as well in her segment. But that's definitely one of them. And the fact that it's Star Wars on top of everything else, it's like they take every opportunity to play that card that they can. And yeah, you're right. It seemed a little bit more obvious than usual.
Yeah. Now they've got to get away. And Deke's suggestion is to go up the chute. And they're figuring, well, it's not an elevator. How are we going to get up there? He's got an anti-gravity device. And I'm wondering, does it contain gravitonium or?
Or does it work some other way? Yeah. Especially since I thought there was reference to the fact that it only had a certain number of charges. And I thought 3 was the number that was mentioned, although maybe I just made that up. But they took people up there 2 at a time or sometimes even 1 at a time. I think Yo-Yo went alone. So, yeah, I was surprised that he was able to use it the way they did. I mean, obviously, it's good they did, but.
Now, Daisy says Fitzsimmons go first. Is that the first time we've heard the actual name Fitzsimmons used, or am I just forgetting? We've heard
it
before.
Well, it goes back so far, because they were introduced that way back in season 1, and people were using it all the time. as a collective noun. So it hasn't been used that way in a long time.
Okay. But I did like the more subtle reference, Alan Z, which was Doctor number 10, played by David Tennant in Doctor Who. He used that all the time.
Yeah.
So whether that's a call to Doctor Who or not, I don't know, but certainly more subtle than the Boba Fett reference. But so they get in the trawler and nobody knows how to fly it.
Yeah, that's great. And it seems surprising that that's the case. I do like that they went to Coulson's car as a go-to for why he might be able to do it. And of course, I guess Mac had a small amount of training. Was that the other person that they were originally going to go with?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, and this is part of the problem. And again, I get the ethics that are involved here and the morality questions, because Flint basically knows how to fly the trawler, right? Mm-hmm. He says Virgil had been...
Oh, that's who it was. It was Flint that they were going
to
use.
Right, yeah. Had been training him to fly it, but he doesn't want to abandon the people on the rock. And I get that. That's very noble of him. But I go back to what I said earlier. What do you really think you're going to be able to accomplish? And maybe it's something that I'm just not seeing.
Well, here's the thing. What do they think they're going to accomplish? I mean, see it from Flint's point of view. Here these people are going off to escape the station, certainly, so that they can do something, but they don't actually have a plan, do they?
Well, they don't have a plan, but I think, you know, hovering in the background is we need to save the Earth from this fate.
And Flint is being hunted, so how much good can he do when he's on the run?
Right.
Yeah, so, that's a good point.
Now, I love the scene where Fitz tells Mac that he hid the shield weapons in the past. And then when Mac is told where they are, level 3, where the blood-sucking aliens are, and then Fitz is like, dude, are you kidding me? I did all this. I think you're missing everything I did here.
I pulled a Bill and Ted. Come on. How was I supposed to know?
And then Mac's reaction was just classic. It was beautiful. I loved it. So now you mentioned Coulson. Look, how hard can it be? I have a flying car.
That's right. And he does at least disengage it and turn it around effectively enough. But he says, landing it will be pretty much impossible, not only for someone who could fly, but also because this thing has no landing gear.
Right. All right. So, you know, we're talking about them landing on the surface, and we know May and Enoch are down there. And we first see May trying to get her bearings on the surface, and she's being pursued by the Vrelnexians. But Enoch ends up saving her. And again, I love, that's the third Vrelnexian I've killed. Not to toot my own horn.
Yeah, he's very deadpan with his delivery. And he keeps yanking our chain with regard to his true nature. Is he a robot? Is he not a robot? Now he finally says, no, I'm not a robot. I'm a sentient Chronomicon, which he already told us. And we're still kind of bouncing back and forth because obviously the roaches don't find him very tasty, whatever he is. But May also obviously doesn't trust him from the very start. She just has his word that he's been sent by Fitz. She doesn't really have any context for who this guy is.
Well, that's right. And that's part of the beauty of his character is that we don't really know what a Chronicom is.
You're right.
It's not part of the existing Marvel catalog. So at this point, we're just taking little tidbits of information as we go along. But here's what I'm wondering, whether or not it means anything. He says, Fitz sent me, you who will save humanity, May, Simmons, and Coulson. Mm-hmm. That's it. Why only three names? Why not all of them?
Well, especially since he took more than that from the diner, including Mac and Yo-Yo. So I don't know. Maybe he's just honing in on a prophecy from Robin that we don't know about.
Well, May gets to put another name on the list of people that she needs to pay back for making unkind comments about her physical abilities at this point, because he's surprised that she can still stand, even though she claims to be a fighter, and he tells her it might be time for a career change.
Not smart. He doesn't know. He's a Chronomicon. What does he know? But yeah. I also like the interaction with them based on the fact that he has to repeat Philip J. Coulson's name so that she can recognize the voice as the one from the diner. So now she does have a context for who he is, and she does not like it.
Right. Now, at the end of that scene, who or what pulls May back to the surface? Is that just being Robin pulling her up with some sort of a, you know, into the Zephyr? I guess that's what that was.
I don't know. I thought that it was just one of her sidekicks with the helmet that we saw. So I don't know if it was some anonymous person, but certainly they were rescued by whoever is on the surface. And if Robin has got an enclave that maybe was prepared for the cataclysm, that would make sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, May recognizes the interior as the Zephyr.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about Fitz and Hunter. What did they do with the Zephyr? And as far as I know, they took it to the lighthouse, which
it's still parked there,
which is why Robin still has it and why it looks a little worse for wear. I don't know if she's been taking it out for joyrides or not, but there is that. And, you know, finally, the last thing I guess I wanted to mention, and we've kind of talked about it as we've gone along, and that's Flint having to deal with all the changes that he's gone through. I mean, it's one thing to go through Terra Genesis and find out that you have been blessed or cursed with an ability, and he's got to deal with that. He's killed people at this point. He's got to deal with Tess's death, which is very difficult. This poor kid's got a lot to absorb in a very short period of time.
And you know what? I don't really blame him too much for wanting to do his own thing because, you know, as they all get together and reunite, Daisy gives a big hug to everybody. And in the meantime, Flint has gone off to make that rock bullet and kill the giant Kree that's been calling for his return and probably was the one that killed Tess. And so the fact that he takes that particular Kree out has a certain amount of justice to it. But, you know, it makes sense for him to be doing that. He doesn't know these people, and he wants to have his revenge. That makes sense. And he doesn't want to cause any more trouble for his people by being on the lam. I mean, they saw it as a reward to be gathered up, and they don't know, of course, what's being done to the Inhumans. But, you know, who can blame him for trying to follow the same path that all the many other people who have gone through Terra Genesis in the lighthouse have done before him?
Yeah, and I think that's fair to say. And that's why I really like the approach that Mac is taking with Flint, which it's anything but heavy-handed. He's really trying to keep a low key, which is not necessarily in Mac's nature.
Right.
Especially when dealing with adults. And we have a little bit of experience with him dealing with a child, but not a lot. And certainly he's older than a child. He's a teenager.
So I'm here if you need me. And obviously, that's going to be true moving forward, too, as he and Yo-Yo help Flint with whatever they help him with. And you know what's going to happen, of course. Narratively, it's going to become necessary for them to be there for something that will probably tie into what's going on with those on the surface. So I'm sure there will be full circle eventually. All right. Well, it was a lot of fun. I definitely enjoyed this episode. It had its hiccups, of course, but we're obviously moving towards something. And the fact that we're moving towards the surface to give us a change of scenery, I think, can only be a good thing. But one thing we were lacking, as I mentioned, was the humor. And of course, I'm sure Faith scrounged around for some. She did give us a Cole Sass report. So let's go ahead and take a listen to what she came up with.
Hello, everyone. I'm a little under the weather, but that's not going to stop me from getting you the Cole Sass Report. The team is finally back together, if only for a few minutes, and we did get some sass in the process. Before we get to those, the winner from last week. It seems that most of you feel as strongly about tacos as Mac.
I crossed it over 3 weeks earlier after eating fish soup and tacos.
What are tacos?
What the hell kind of future is this?
And now for this week's contenders. Number one, push-ups.
By the way, fight to the death. Really.
Yeah, well, I had to make a splashy entrance.
Yeah, well, you could have jumped in the octagon yourself then.
No, it wouldn't be fair. I do push-ups now. Double digits, so.
Number two, Mr. and Mrs. Boba Fett.
Mr. and Mrs. Boba Fett will be here any minute. So what do we do now?
Number three, not enough credit.
You're kidding me.
You mean that level infested with aliens that suck your blood?
Why was I I feel like I'm not getting enough credit here. I have traveled through time and space to find you. I think we're moving past that bit a little bit too quickly.
And number four, flying car.
So taking off is easy enough. Docking is the hard part.
and landing, that's impossible on account of these ships weren't built with landing gear.
So you have no idea what you're doing.
I got a flying car. How different can it be?
Did I miss your favorite moment? Hopefully not. Please be sure to tweet your favorites for next week to FBMC with the hashtag ColSass. Thanks, Taltos, for your tweets this week and every week. To vote for this week's contenders, please visit facebook.com/groups/agentsofshieldgsm. While you do that, I'm going to get the pints and gin ready for Fitzsimmons. Have a great week, everybody.
All right. There's some good ones in there. So if you want to go ahead and vote on the Facebook group, that's where we've been doing that. And it was a little bit less of a close call last week. So we'll see if there's a clear winner this time around, since they're not all uproariously funny as they usually are. But let's go ahead and get into our listener feedback here. We've got a few of them. Skimmins chimed in, of course. She says, keeping with the Star Wars theme, if Gemma is meant to mimic Leia's look in The Force Awakens and Fitz is Han, they got divorced. I'm just saying. May is what Terminators wish they could be. Again, I ask, if the mission is to save humanity, why not just ask, why kidnap the team? Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks, this guy. I love when Deke said that about Fitz. This week is clearly Deke sass over Cole sass. Of course, Daisy is going to make sure Gemma is safe first. Again, with the yo-yo exit worry, have you two heard anything on this being her and possibly Mac's final season? Because they've been putting her in potential out situations a lot recently, it feels. I don't think so. I don't think there's any talk of having her move on. So I think it's just regular old narrative danger. You stab your enemies in the back and in the front. Some Cassius sass there. That sequence was great. The fact they worked together to wipe out the brother made it even better. And I love we got some history on him and Sonara. It's going to be interesting to see how this affects things with the father, and will one turn on the other for him in the end, or will they go out together, seek revenge for whoever falls? 50% of me feels for Fitzsimmons fans during the turbulence moment, as I know what it's like to have your favorite ship messed up, but the other 50% totally yelled, "The universe is a Skimmins shipper," when they didn't complete the kiss. Overall, a good episode. Thank you, Skimmins, as always.
Yep. And we heard from Taltos, who says, Flint took out the Kree guard with a rock cluster through the eye. He seems to be mastering his powers awfully fast, given that he's had them about a day.
Yeah.
And I forget who it was that asked about Flint and how he would respond in a fight. And, you know, it was, he's semi-competent. I forget the wording they used, but certainly that idea came up. At least Flint knows how to actually kill his enemies. The S.H.I.E.L.D. team only seems to be knocking people out. Though if Gemma and Daisy had actually killed Cassius and Sonara, would they be better or worse off having Falnak tracking them down instead? Good point.
Yes.
Fitz told Mac and Elena he had hid a crate of S.H.I.E.L.D. tech in a wall on level 3. Really, Fitz? They just told you that level is crawling with aliens that suck your blood, and you couldn't be bothered to give them directions that are a tad more precise? At least narrow it down to a room.
Oh, well, now, that is a good point. Once you find out that it's going to be difficult, he might have said something about, look for the panel under the bench or something like that.
Yeah, but I guess that was a chance for Fitz to remind them, I traveled through time for you people.
So. You're going to have to do the rest on your own.
Yeah. All right. After this adventure, clearly all of the team needs to take some rudimentary piloting lessons. It seems likely there'll be another emergency when they'll need to fly something when their pilot's unavailable. It's actually kind of surprising they didn't already have mandatory lessons, given there's a high probability anyone on the team could get injured during a mission. Good point.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that too. They went through two redundancies, though, although I guess Flint doesn't really count. They didn't have him beforehand, but I agree. I think they should have someone besides May be trained in piloting things. But the trawler is a completely different animal anyway, so you're already behind the eight ball there. All right, and we heard just a quick comment from Salim, who I believe is a first-time commenter. So thank you very much, Salim, for commenting here. He wanted to mention about Patrick Fabian, who played Panarion last week. Patrick Fabian, he says, will always be Professor Lasky from Saved by the Bell, The College Years, to me. He also took a turn as a villain of the week on Burn Notice. And Burn Notice is a show I did check out for a little while. So that doesn't surprise me that he played a villain. He's got that air about him. Enjoyed seeing him here with Fitz and Cassius. And yeah, I guess that was just a one episode guest shot for Patrick Fabian. But yeah, it's always good to see some recognizable faces in there. So thank you, Salim. And I'm going to interrupt the podcast here for a moment because we did get one last feedback. Came in a little bit later after we finished recording, but I wanted to give John a chance to speak. This is John's thoughts on the current episode.
Hi, everybody. This is John. Yeah, once more into the breach, Alonzi. Chimon gave a great shout-out to David Tennant's Doctor Who. I wonder if she was in the running to replace Capaldi. So what an arc for Cassius and Sonara all in one episode. Jeez, maximum Kree body count. And we got to see our favorite Chronicon from Cygnus X-1. He sounds more and more like a time cop. I didn't quite catch the significance of what Fitz discovered about how they generate their gravity. Was that a reference to something from Peggy Carter's series or maybe the first season that I missed? But in any event, I think it's meant to give us an idea of what really destroyed the Earth. The gravity storms that May and Enoch encountered were certainly meant to point that out. It gives you a lot of ideas. Oh, well, that's all I got. Y'all have a great week. Bye.
All right, John, thank you very much. And of course, Dave's not here to comment on this with me, but as I'm editing the podcast, I just wanted to say thanks. And you probably figured out that the gravitonium that you were asking about was from season one. So you probably heard that earlier in the podcast, but thanks for your thoughts. And now we'll go ahead and go back to the podcast as originally recorded. But we had a lot of great comments there, and I hope you really enjoyed this episode as much as we did. But that's going to be it for this edition of The Sandbox. Keep up with show news and fan interaction by following us on Twitter at @Shield_GSM, and our popular Facebook group is at facebook.com/groups/AgentsOfShieldGSM, which is also where you can vote on the Kolsas report.
And Mike and I'll be back next week with our discussion of episode 8 of season 5 entitled The Last Day. But remember, after the episode airs, you can head on over to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback to share your thoughts. Write us a message, record a comment using your computer's microphone, or just call 304-837-2278.
And remember to review and rate The Sandbox wherever you get your podcasts to let us know how you're enjoying our coverage of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
So remember, you can't blame gravity for falling in love.